Radio Cherry Bomb is produced by Heritage Radio Network, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station devoted to all things food. Help keep HRN alive by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate. Were you into avocado toast before any of your friends? Do you know how to whip up some cashew cream? And do you make your own almond milk? If so, you're our kind of person, and you might be interested in the classes at the Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts, located in the heart of Manhattan. Founded in 1977, NGI is the first culinary school dedicated to healthy cooking to be accredited nationally. Their professional chef's training program is offered full and part-time, and several of our favorite chefs are alumni, including Dirt Candy's Amanda Cohen, Alyssa Wagner of Dimes, and Chloe Coscarelli of By Chloe. Visit the NGI website to learn how you can transform your life and your career. Beginning as Balducci's Fruit Stand in Greenwich Village 70 years ago, Baldor Specialty Foods has been curating and delivering the highest quality foods in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries. Chefs rely on Baldor for the freshest and most seasonal ingredients, along with new and exciting items that you just can't get elsewhere. Baldor's ordering process is designed with a chef's schedule and priorities in mind to get you what you need when you need it. Baldor is the trusted resource and partner for the region's top chefs. Learn what Baldor can do for your business today at baldorfood.com. Everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, co-founder and editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. All summer long, we're sharing some of our favorite talks and panels from this year's Cherry Bomb Jubilee, our annual celebration of women doing remarkable things in the world of food. First, here are the sponsors who keep Radio Cherry Bomb on the air. The Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts, where you can start your journey to becoming a natural food chef today. Baldor Specialty Foods, which curates and delivers the best and freshest food in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries. Prince Street, the fresh new podcast with a culinary heart from Dean and DeLuca. Today's recording is a panel called So You Want to Be a Farmer. A lot of people fantasize about having a farm these days. Maybe you're one of them. So we wanted to get some actual farmers in the room to talk about the realities of a life working the land. From an urban gardener working with public high school students to a fashion editor slash orchard owner, our panelists are sophisticated, smart, and incredibly hardworking. They include Leah Penniman of Soulfire Farm, Molly Culver of The Youth Farm, Katie Baldwin and Amanda Merrow of Amber Waves Farm, and Laura Ferrara of West Wind Orchard. The moderator is Aaron Fairbanks, executive director of Heritage Radio and host of the network's Farm Report show. Our panel will begin right after this message from our sponsor, the Prince Street Podcast.
Today's episode is brought to you by Prince Street, Dean and DeLuca's monthly podcast dedicated to the delicious and infinite connections between people and food. Each new Prince Street podcast features special guests, field reports, and meals from around the world. Editor-in-Chief Howie Kahn hosts the show, featuring segments from correspondents such as Griffin Dunn, Jay McInerney, Eden Grinchpan, and Sierra Tishgart. Download Prince Street on iTunes and online at livefromprincestreet.com. Prince Street, a fresh new podcast with a culinary heart.
Let's see, about 10 years ago, I sat up in my futon in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and realized there was a stack of food books in bed with me, on the floor next to me, and I had a moment where I was like, maybe you don't want to go to law school. And I was like, I want to work in food, but what does that even mean? Like, what are the jobs? Like, what are the things that you can do? And so I made a short list. I was going to work in a kitchen for a year and become a master chef. I was going to do a year of like advocacy and nonprofit work and learn how to change the world. And I was going to spend a year on a farm and know everything there was to know about farming and agriculture. And like many 24-year-olds, my understanding of like how much there was to learn didn't really match up. And I remember the first day I arrived at Flying Pig's Farm up in Shushan, New York, I got out of the truck and was like, holy shit, what am I doing here? And so I'm hoping that we can talk a little bit about moving forward on things even when you're not exactly sure what you're doing. And we're going to start with you, Molly. I'm wondering, why do you think people are attracted to farming?
So that's a really big question. I think, in a nutshell, people are attracted to farming, like I was, because they feel like something is broken. They feel either burnt out, and I see a lot of people come through the training program that I run at the youth farm and also at Farm School NYC, which is a urban school for learning how to farm. They come because they're burnt out and they miss connection with nature. They're tired of being at their desk. Coupled with they love food, and we're all New Yorkers, we love food. And they want to take that desire to understand the farmer to another level. They want transparency. They want to understand how food is grown. They want to make that connection for themselves, which is really a radical one. But I think deep down, it's really about connecting to something that is something we've been doing for thousands of years. This is nothing new. It's not like us up here are doing something original. It's just a very human urge to connect to land and to connect to soil, connect to food. It shouldn't be a privilege, and there are a lot of hardships involved as well, but it is a privilege to be a farmer, and I think it's a really natural desire to want to connect.
Leah, I've heard that farming without an economic imperative is called gardening, that farms are, you know, a business, and that means that you do things and you make decisions differently. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you see farms as a business and what the role of a farm is.
Sure. Well, you're right. I mean, the USDA defines a farm as grossing over $1,000 in crops, which you could easily do out of a garden space. Our farm has a joint mission of both being a business but also serving a food justice imperative. And so we run everything through a subscription program that our members affectionately call their Netflix for vegetables. And we deliver, you know, a box of food every week that includes vegetables, fruits, and a protein source. And we only serve low-income families in food desert neighborhoods. And the way that we're able to do that is by bringing in money on the side through educational programming. So there's a joint business, nonprofit, food justice model, but through that we are able to provide 80 to 100 families who would not have fresh food with this doorstep delivery of abundant, organically grown, you know, wonderful produce, and then also be able to advocate and educate in the community as well.
How did you know you were allowed to do it like that?
It was really, there was not a model for that. We really responded to community need. I've been farming since I was a teenager. I was one of those lost urban kids that didn't know who I was and someone was trying to save. And I got a summer job on a farm, and it felt like something real and rooted and grounded. And I knew that I'd want to have a farm eventually. So after working on other people's farms, it was really the moment when our neighbors said to us, you know, we don't have any good food to eat. I was living in downtown Albany. It's a food desert neighborhood with no grocery stores. Like, will you grow food for us? And we made it work for that particular community. And the same thing with all of our training programs for farmers and our work with youth. The community asked us to do it, and we responded using, you know, our heart and intelligence. So we weren't following a model. We were just listening.
Thank you. Thanks for doing that. Katie, I want to talk a little bit about land access, which is like one of the biggest barriers for people who are getting started in farming. And you guys got access to your land in kind of a unique way, and I'm wondering if you can tell us what that was.
Sure. So to provide context to where we are farming, on the east end of Long Island in the village of Amagansett. So the land values in considered the Hamptons is extraordinarily high. So for a new and beginning farmer, your options to access land is to lease land, either from a private landowner
or the Peconic Land Trust, in our case, has been actively working to conserve farmland so we don't get totally blown out by McMansions out there. So we are currently working with the town of East Hampton and lease land from them. And we also lease from our local land trust. And then there are also, there's a deep history of agriculture in East Hampton where you have farming families that have been in the business for 15 or 16 generations that have seen a complete evolution of the space and want to maintain a thoroughfare for new farmers to create these access points. So that's often called land link, where retiring farmers are trying to connect with beginning farmers. And that's active where we are, but that's also active in New York State and in the Northeast and actually throughout the country.
So I have a lease for my apartment, and it gets renewed every year. When you're leasing on a farm and you're like thinking about investing in infrastructure like water lines or greenhouses, how do you know that you can do that, that you have security from year to year?
That's a great question, and I was reminded of how sometimes seemingly insane it is that Amanda and I decided just to jump in on leased land. We were on a 3-acre lease term, or a three-year lease term. We bumped it up to 5. Woohoo! We asked for 99, and they were like, "That's crazy." But the idea is, like, as a farmer, you're building soil, and it is your currency in building that. And healthy soils are healthy plants for healthy people. So that's really kind of what we're getting at, and that's difficult to do, and you have to put a lot of faith and trust in a lot of your community around you that's going to support you to make it seem like a good idea that you're putting a lot of time and energy and literally sweat equity into your soil. But there are now opportunities to begin purchasing land, specifically on the East End. So we are working towards that because it's important, but I think as a farmer, whether you're leasing, and this is something that our mentor taught us, whether you're leasing or owning the land, you still have the same level of responsibility. You are a steward and a caretaker of a place, and then I think when you put that good energy into the soil, then you're fed back. So it's kind of weird, but I think it's just trusting also that it's going to work out for the best.
Yeah. Amanda, kind of still on this topic of land, I think when you're thinking about going into farming, you have your kind of dream list of like what you want to grow and what it's going to be like. And then you have the realities of the piece of property and what it can do and what is situated there. Can you talk a little bit about what you thought kind of coming in and then lessons learned when you guys started actually putting stuff in the ground?
Katie and I met doing an apprenticeship around the corner from where we currently farm. And we spent that season together, you know, being the lowest on the totem of just being field apprentices. And we had so much time to talk about what we might like to grow and do. And we really started with these fantastic ideas of having a fabric farm. So raising animals for wool and raising flax for linen and raising dye plants and going in that direction, or having a pizza farm that would fill, you know, we could grow our own pizzas, seemed like the most fun thing ever. And so these dream big conversations really, that pizza conversation really kicked it off, because we started thinking, hey, wait a minute, we can get all of the ingredients for pizza locally except for small grains. Why is no one growing small grains on Long Island? We have such a diverse food shed out there. Being close to the water, we of course have seafood, and there's meat and vegetables and fruits and honey and beer and wine, but no grains. And so we set out to bring them back, and we learned that Long Island was the first place in the United States that European settlers were growing grains, which was an exciting thing for us to figure out. And so as we've gone over the last 7 seasons, we've trialed what works with wheat, what works with rye. Oh no, the deer eat this variety. And so as a farmer, one of the most, I think, exciting and rewarding things is that you get to start your season over every year, but with new lessons from the prior year.
And so we're just putting together what one of our young women who works with us calls her backpack of knowledge of going forward. And so we, as we get to know our soil and our land, we're just learning about wet spots and dry spots and great areas of the soil. And then also the reality of what your customers want to buy and how you can support your community with, do people want to eat locally grown wheat? Do they prefer cucumbers? What, you know, how can we make a living and also do what's fun for us and engage the community in what we're growing and make sure that they care and are engaged.
Laura, I feel like one of the reoccurring conversations in the city over the last month has been about the weather. It's so cold, it's so hot, it's like raining, it's freezing, and like I don't know what to wear, and that's such a big problem. What's going on at your orchard right now? How is the weather translating to the work that you guys are doing?
Well, unfortunately, this year we probably lost our crop of apples. You know, due to the climate, which of course has been a big conversation in the past couple of years, it's really affected what we can do on the farm. So we hadn't had much snow this year, which the trees need snow in order to kill insects and become sweeter apples. Because it, the spring started so early this year, our buds were out. It snowed, which was beautiful, but the snow didn't kill the buds. It was the frost. So the last three nights, my husband's up there trying to make a fire around the apple trees. We're an organic apple orchard. We don't have big fans to keep the trees warm. And this year we decided to invest in a sprayer instead of fans, which as a farm, you're making these decisions all the time, where to put your investment. And so we decided to go with the sprayer, which was the wrong choice. And so we lost our crop of apples. Now, this has happened through the years, and we've learned through trial and error ourselves. And through that, then we try to save what we can. So because of that, that's how we started making jams, for instance. We lost our crop of apples. We knew we would have raspberries, and we thought, well, let's make jam or pizza. And we started growing our own vegetables, and we decided for years we wanted a pizza oven. We're both from Italy, and my mother-in-law comes to help us 3 months out of the year. And we decided, well, you know, it's normal for us. We'll just make pizza. So what we grow on the farm, zucchini blossoms, eggplant, kale, we use all those products on our pizza. And, you know, what we thought was just going to be a weekend was to have food for some of the people that came to visit us. It turned into people just coming for pizza and to hang out and to meet other people. And so this community started, not just for the apples, but to exchange ideas. And here we are.
Always coming back to pizza. I like it. Leah, when you are using farming as a tool to both feed people but also to address race-based disparities, I'm wondering, you know, at the end of the day, the week, the year, how are you measuring your success? I mean, how do you know that you are having an impact, making a difference?
I was just talking to our board about this because of course, it's relatively straightforward for us to determine how many pounds of food we're getting, you know, to a certain demographic of people, and we do that, and we can count how many youth go through our programs and their grades in school. But I feel like the biggest outcome oftentimes, particularly for African heritage people who come through our programs, is healing. It's really about hope and healing and belonging, because there's a long, long history of land-based oppression through slavery, through sharecropping, through people being forcibly driven off their land in the South, and it was a big push factor in the Great Migration. And there's a lot of inherited trauma, so adults will have almost an allergic reaction to the land. And I don't do stoop work. Children will want to stay in the van with their earbuds in and their hoods pulled over. And it's this process of reintroducing our community to the land and really reclaiming that right to belong and to actually participate in the food system. Like right now, less than 1% of farmland in this country is owned by African American people. It's not a historical accident. So we've been talking a lot about how do you measure that experience. You know, when a young person comes and takes his shoes off for the first time and feels the soil under his feet and has memories and connections with his ancestors and feels belonging and is able to smile, you know. So we play around with things like the Hope Index or the happiness index, but really it's bigger than that. You know, and we don't want to diminutize the importance of that type of land-based healing necessarily by always looking through a metric. So we tell stories also.
Molly, why is diversity in farming important? And how do you kind of create that? Like, how do you set an intention around that and activate that?
Yeah, well, you know, to speak to Leah's point, obviously, there's a huge lack of diversity in the farming population in all kinds of ways. Age, so most farmers that own land or own an operation are over the age of 50 at this point. And so we need younger people getting into farming. As Leah pointed out, there is a huge lack of Black, Latino farmers, other farmers of color represented in the farming population. We also need more queer farmers. We need farmers that essentially don't look white and male and 50. and while they're great, we need that diversity because that's what makes a strong food system. You know, I think what we're learning as eaters is, you know, that our individual acts make a difference, right? Like what we buy, if we buy Laura's apples, that's really important because it sustains her family, it helps sustain our farming heritage in this region, it helps protect our water sources because she's managing the land ecologically. All of those choices matter. And as a person with various types of privilege, white privilege, privilege of college education, privilege of being right-handed, many different privileges, heterosexual, right? I feel like it's my responsibility to, in this community of food justice activists, to be an ally to that and opening up diversity and opportunities for people that don't look like me to farm. And to create spaces for everybody to share their resources and not necessarily to always be the teacher. And so at the Youth Farm, we really try to exemplify different farming traditions and really underscore the idea that farming is a shared human heritage, but many cultures in many places have perfected the art of organic farming. And again, this is nothing new. Organic farming is the baseline of what many, many cultures have done for millennia. And so just, you know, bringing people into that is really exciting and remembering that this is for everyone to do, but also taking a really pointed and active role in opening up access to farming skills and just creating spaces for sharing that knowledge that exists. So, yeah.
Kind of on that note, Leah, you guys run a Undoing Racism Farmer Immersion Program that is focusing on folks who have benefited from white privilege. And I'm like, who comes to that? How's that going? Like, what are you talking about? What's the response of the community been?
Sure. Well, again, everything we do is really in response to people asking things of us. So for many years, we've had the Black and Latino Farmers Immersion, and that came out of us realizing that folks who were from the Bronx, for example, to go from that experience to a full season apprenticeship on the farm was just too big of a step. So we needed like a smaller introduction in a culturally safe space where there was time for processing and looking at history and building community. So we developed these shorter programs for beginning farmers. But then folks who weren't Black or Latino were saying, well, we want to do something like that too, that really focuses on justice and culture, and also experienced farmers were saying, we want to do that too. So we've started to diversify our programming. This is the first year where we're looking at supporting white folks in leadership in food justice and farming organizations to be able to bring an undoing oppression analysis and strategy back to their organizations. So we have a waiting list over 100 for that program. I mean, people are really, really interested in figuring out how to be anti-racist and how to change the face of farming and food to be truly inclusive and equitable. And we think the best use of our limited resources is to train trainers. So we're working with executive directors and managers of programs and learning from one another, really, in that space.
Katie, also building and bringing and creating more opportunities for women in farming, you guys run an interesting kind of internship program. Can you talk a little bit about why it's important and if you guys specifically like selected women or did women find you?
I'm so happy to say that two of our young women farmers are with us, Colleen and Adrian, today, and they're a huge support system. So we have come out of, thanks, especially thanks to you guys. Amanda and I are, have come out of an apprenticeship program. We did a training program, and this is our way of paying it forward, because it seemed, when I was getting out of my career in foreign policy, it seemed difficult to get into a career of organic farming. And it was brought to my attention that one option to do this is to take an apprenticeship, and you essentially take a year to get your hands dirty on an organic farm so you can learn how to be a farmer. And we felt that it was important to us to offer an apprenticeship program to allow anybody, not just necessarily women, but to your point, I think women find us, and I think the current that we're hearing today is that's okay with us. Women find us, and it tends to be mostly women who want to work with us. That's great. I mean, we need to grow many, many more farmers in this country. It's kind of the most important thing as farmers we should be doing is training more farmers as quickly as possible, because we are about to go through a generational shift. So we need the man and woman power. But the apprenticeship program really offers, you learn how to grow a tomato, for sure. But in the spirit of transparency and running a small business, and a small farm business specifically, we also are teaching our apprentices how to market the product, how to keep the books. Farmers, as we all know on this panel, and all of you in the audience especially, know that you wear many hats in your role. So we're farmers, but we're also trying to teach the range of skill sets according to what it means to be a farmer. But it's 10 lady farmers this year at Amber Waves Farm, so we're thrilled.
Nice. Expanding on that a little bit, Amanda, you know, one of the things I find shocking and just sad is that many farmers across the country don't actually take an income for themselves. They're not actually making any money. They're supporting their business. And I'm wondering, when you think about the operations of your farm and you're thinking about farm workers and employment, like, how do you start to navigate some of those conversations? Are you guys kind of in the black? And when you think about making additions with regards to staffing, what are the, like, factors that make that easier or harder for you?
That's a great and really layered question that could be, if you zoomed out, you could say, well, you know, a huge problem that we're facing is that the price of food is artificially low, which is steeped in the system in this country that of that's steeped in a system of slavery and cheap labor and cheap food and oppression. That's a problem. So that's, you know, stepping back, that's certainly something that's going on. We think of our farm as a for-profit and not-for-profit hybrid. So about half of the work we do is education-based work that we're fundraising for. So that's our apprenticeship program. And then also we have an educational director who's working with all of the local schools in our area, and we welcome children to the farm for free and offer free educational programming to the public. And we, you know, I think one of the exciting things about so many new farms popping up in different places is that farms can really be a reflection of their community. And where we are in the Hamptons, we have the tremendous opportunity to do really great fundraising work to underwrite the programs that we want to do at the farm. And we also have a really savvy New York clientele that's willing to pay for high quality produce. And so between those two things, we're lucky in that way. When Katie and I started the farm, it was 2008 when we were coming out of our farming apprenticeship, and it didn't seem that scary because it felt like there were no jobs. So I was like, what else are we going to do? So that first year, we paid ourselves each $2,500. And I was just looking at our books the other day. And
for the year?
For the year.
$2,500
each.
For the year.
For the year. we just had a lot of jokes for years about tough economic times. And they were. And people gave us cheap rents, and we lived with other people. And we kind of worked our way up. And farmers making living wages, not only farm executives and people in places of privilege like us who, operate our farm and control our salaries, but also fair wages for farm laborers all over the country is such a huge issue. One of the reasons that we're so transparent with our new people who are coming in and with our people who stay with us year after year is to try to climb them as much as we can through our salary ladder and send out people into the world of agriculture who are really pumped to hire and do great work and pay fair wages. And it is a constant struggle.
Does anyone else want to jump in on that? It's okay if you don't.
The thing about having a farm and how many hats you wear. You really are like a jack of all trades, a master of none. That's what I feel like a lot of the times because I'm really an apprentice. I hold farmers in such high regard that I would never call myself a farmer because I'm not a chemist and a scientist and a mechanic. You have to have so much knowledge in order to have a farm. And the farmers around us are, 15 generation of farmers. They're not organic. Most of them are not because they can't afford to grow organic. They can't afford to lose their crop. We can because we have day jobs. We have we've been doing this 14 years. It was accidental. As the girls spoke before, yes, a passion moves you, and it moves you to create. But then there's also the reality that you have to, work. You have to work hard. The shit hits the fan. Relying on your crops every year and you lose your crops, well, what do you do? So we don't take a salary. We're self-financed and all the money we make goes back into the farm. So I think it's hard to say I just want to grow organic or I just want to have a certain amount. We have a very small staff. It's the three of us, it's our family that comes to help, and our local farmers are the ones that have helped us the most. They've inspired us to save the trees. These were 60 years old, these trees, and they're the ones that came to help us and give us information. They still do. If a tractor breaks, Jack will come over and help my husband fix it. So I think it's important, this community of locals that are around you. It's not just us, but we need all the help we can get, and people are willing to help you if you put out the love and dedication, and it's authentic.
I feel like that's another kind of like on her statistic is the number of people who have farms but also have off-farm jobs because the farm can't support a family. I want to kind of go down the line, starting with you, Leah, and hear from you guys where you go kind of for nourishment, for inspiration, when you need to kind of get a little extra, and what you might want to share with the audience today, whether it's a painting or a book or a saying or a personal practice, what kind of keeps you ticking?
Now you got my heart racing on this whole like state of agriculture and salaries. You guys should read, light reading, the USDA 2012 agricultural census. Like over 90% of farmers in the United States are making under $8,000 a year. We have a food crisis, so and we need some really smart people like folks here to think about how to fix that. But my sanity comes from going on a 3 to 5 mile run every morning at 5 a.m., no matter how dark, snowy, rainy, or hot it is. That's what I do.
That's a great question. I am usually so tired at the end of a farming day. I don't really, oddly, like to cook for myself, but I'm like growing all this food, and it's like the quality of the food is extraordinary, and I just can't get beyond slicing a tomato. So sometimes that's just good enough, and that is just, I've learned that, like, yeah, well, you put a lot of love into that tomato, so just slice that tomato and go to bed, and that's fine. And in addition to that, we're fortunate enough to farm near the beach, and I use the ocean and the water around us as kind of a counterbalance to the boots on the ground land part of my life, which is most of it, but absorbing the energy of the ocean for me is a big one.
I guess the short answer would be petting my cat. It really calms me down. Singing wherever, whenever I can really helps me. And this time of year always leaves me feeling incredibly crazy just because I'm managing a farm and I'm teaching and a lot of things are happening all at once. But the community of people that are involved in food and farming in the city is incredibly inspiring. And I was teaching a class yesterday on propagation in my greenhouse and had such an amazing group of people of all walks of life sharing in conversation about where we want to see our food system go. And I just felt like I'm so glad that I'm here, even though I'm exhausted. And it's really that the community. So I encourage you all to join it.
I think for me, I'm just always aware of how much work my family were. They were farmers in Italy, and they worked so hard to come to the United States for a better life, right? Because farming was so difficult. And, you know, I have siblings, and we all went to college and thought, like, well, I'm not ever going to grow a vegetable. That I wasn't interested in that. My parents grew vegetables in our backyard in Brooklyn, and I was embarrassed of that, right? Because it wasn't so, I mean, now it's the greatest thing in the world. It's epicenter of urban farming. But at that time, it wasn't in the 70s. So for me, I'm very grateful that my family has instilled in us how important food is. Food is really the center where everything else happens, and it's farming is that. It's growing a community. It's bringing other people. It's sharing love. I mean, you're growing something, and you're sharing that. So I think I just remind myself when things get really tough, and they do. I mean, I can't get anything done sometimes during the day, or I think I can't. But I remember that there were generations of people that worked really hard to get us here, and in a way, it's a respect, and it's giving back to a community. It's giving back and being grateful for what you have and growing it and maybe inspiring someone else and being inspired, because I am inspired every day. I would never have met the people that I meet, you know, at the pig farm when we're picking out pigs or the seed library. So I just remind myself that I'm lucky to be in this position, and it's a choice, and not everyone has a choice in life. So
I think, well, I'm an avid list maker, and I have them all around me. And last season I started doing this. I have my regular list that's going, and then in the back of my notebook I have, like, the other list that's, like, just stay focused. And the thing that continually came back to me, especially last season on that list of what matters, the crew and our people. And when I think of the first few years that Katie and I were farming by ourselves, we couldn't buy anything the first year, and we were using, like, 5-gallon buckets, and we didn't have a tractor or knives, or we just didn't know what we were doing. And I look around at our tremendous crew of 10, many of whom have traveled across the country and left their jobs because they feel this pull to agriculture. And they have come to be with us and to be taught by us. And I'm so honored by their commitment of time and so excited about the energy that they're putting in that it just feeds me. And I get excited to keep going. And I just have so much gratitude for that partnership and collaboration, that if I can just focus on that in the back of my notebook of what matters, the crew, then it keeps me grounded.
You guys are amazing and inspiring, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you to these modern farmers for sharing their stories about the vital work they do. If you'd like to attend next year's Jubilee conferences, and yes, that's conferences plural, be sure to sign up for our email list at cherrybomb.com. You'll get the first word on next year's Jubilee conferences in New York and San Francisco. Yes, we are taking it on the road. Thanks to our engineer, Dave Tadashore, and thanks again to our sponsors for supporting this season of Radio Cherry Bomb. Baldor Specialty Foods curates and delivers the best and freshest food in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries. Learn what Baldor can do for your business today at baldorfood.com. Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts. Start your journey to becoming a natural food chef today by visiting ngihca.edu. And Prince Street, a fresh podcast with a culinary heart. For more, visit livefromprincestreet.com or download the Prince Street podcast from iTunes. Thanks for listening, everybody. You are the bomb.
Hi, I'm Abby Swain, and I'm the pastry chef at Kraft and Kraft Bar. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Danielle Spencer. She's the pastry sous chef at Kraft. Danielle's passion to learn keeps me motivated. She is the major force behind Kraft's in-house bread program, and she's turning out some amazing loaves. Danielle, you are the bomb.